Walker, Judge Felton, and I, Judge Petty, will be presiding, and we have the appellant, Ms. Campbell, for the Attorney General, and Mr. Lindsay for the defendant. So, Ms. Campbell, would you like to reserve any time for rebuttal?
Yes, Your Honor. Can I reserve 3 minutes?
3 minutes, you may. You may begin when you're ready.
Great. Thank you, sir. May it please the Court, Lauren Campbell on behalf of the Commonwealth, and today the Commonwealth is asking this Court to reverse the trial court's dismissal of its case based on the false premise that double jeopardy should apply to the defendant's second indictment. And the Commonwealth argues that double jeopardy does not apply to the defendant's second indictment because his first trial did not end in a decision on the merits but ended in a finding of a fatal variance in the charging instrument. And the law is clear that if a person is acquitted of an offense because of a fatal variance in the indictment, that that person may be reindicted on a proper charge.
Ms. Campbell, the court granted the motion to strike. What do we make of the fact that Rule 3A:15 only permits a motion to strike if the evidence is insufficient as a matter of law?
I honestly hadn't really thought that much about that, but I think that perhaps it should have been couched as a motion to dismiss.
But it wasn't, and the motion to strike had a lot more grounds, basis, than simply the fatal variance. There was, for instance, the motion was based on a lack of proof of any trespassory taking, which would relate to the ownership of the property or the possession of the property. So,
yes, Your Honor.
How do we presume if the court granted a motion to strike that it didn't do so based on insufficient evidence?
Well, I don't think you need to presume anything because I do think that the record is very clear exactly what happened at the first instance of the motion to strike. I believe it's is around page 280, a little before that. The court does go through and say that it is not granting on the sufficiency of the evidence, and then, I'm sorry, that's 278, and then it goes when the defendant renews his motion to strike, and he does renew it on the fatal variance and the other sufficiency issues, which he hit a couple of different elements in making those sufficiency challenges, and the court decides to reserve, and when eventually the court comes back, it is very, very clear what the court is ruling on. I think it's unequivocally not ruling on sufficiency of the evidence, but only on the finding of a fatal variance. The court makes it clear on page 354 to 355 to go through and read exactly what the indictment says, explain how the evidence differed from the charging instrument, and find that in light of that, there is a fatal variance existing between the allegation and the evidence, and grants the motion to strike. So, I'm not sure that I can disagree or concede that it wasn't the proper avenue for the defendant in the court to take. I think that is clearly what happened on the record. There was never any finding of insufficiency of the evidence.
Well, but none of that made it into the final order. The final order simply says the court granted the motion to strike previously taken under advisement, and that motion to strike previously taken under advisement includes a number of evidentiary deficiencies. Don't we look to the final order rather than simply what was said at from the bench?
I think you do look. Yes, the court looks to the final order, and that is what happened. But I think you would have to look to know what the motion to strike was granted on anyway. When you're reviewing, especially a double jeopardy issue, you do. That's why the Commonwealth has to file the first transcript in the second case so that the court can look at what happened to see if whether or not there was a double jeopardy issue. So I think in that context, that's why we are looking at the original trial record.
strike and dismisses the case. You then have the second judge basically saying the Commonwealth chose a strategy and the strategy failed, and it doesn't have anything to do with a fatal variance. It has to do with the evidence, and it has to do with the fact that the prior judge made a finding. And, you know, at this juncture, at the appellate juncture, how do you get past that?
Well, as I argued in brief, the second trial judge could not go back and revisit that ruling and determine that she disagreed with the first trial court and wanted to find that it was not a fatal variance and that it was a fatal choice in theory. And I think that is, she plainly didn't have jurisdiction to revisit that ruling. It was a final ruling, and the Commonwealth and the defendant could rely on that being the final ruling, and the second trial court couldn't revisit it. And
but counsel, why wasn't the final ruling what was stated in the order, that the motion to strike is granted and the case is dismissed?
Well, I think that is what happened. I mean, plainly that is what happened, and the case was dismissed, but I think that the case wasn't dismissed for the merits, and that's my argument, and that's what's supported by the record.
Okay, let me move from that just for a moment then, and, you know, assuming it was granted on the fatal variance, you rely quite heavily on our opinion in Purvey versus Commonwealth, and in Purvey, we found that the defendant was indicted for the wrong offense, basically,
mm-hmm.
that the offense proven was not the offense charged. And we reversed, we agreed, and we reversed on that basis. And then there was also a sufficiency argument. Now, the language that you rely on, there's no indication, at this point there was no re-prosecution, because it obviously was up on direct appeal. The language you rely on is prefaced with a comment where we say, we assume Purvey presses this separate challenge, surely aware of the venerable principle of double jeopardy jurisprudence, etc.
Mm-hmm.
Why isn't that, and then we go on to find that the evidence was sufficient. Why isn't that comment just bald dicta? Why does that have anything to do with the resolution of the issue in Purvey?
I'm sorry, I think I'm confused by your question, and I apologize for that.
All right, it was a long question. Why isn't the comment that you relied on regarding the applicability of double jeopardy is not an issue in Purvey at all? Why isn't that comment mere dicta?
I think that it's not mere dicta because in order to address the issue, the court went through the whole process of looking at the indictment, determining the indictment had a fatal variance in it, and then in order for it not to violate double jeopardy, that's why.
But we didn't have to decide whether double jeopardy would preclude further prosecution because we decided that the evidence was sufficient. I mean, it seems to me this is just a comment to the prosecutor, hey, and by the way, feel free to go ahead and re-indict him.
Well, I think whether or not it's dicta, it's also the law based on the code 19.2293 is that when there is a fatal variance, you can re-indict. So I think whether it's a comment or a dicta, or it just is the law, regardless, based on both a statutory.
Are you aware of any case that's addressed the constitutionality of that statute? Whether it is contrary to the double jeopardy clause of both our Constitution and the U.S. Constitution?
I am not aware of a case that directly mentions that statute, but I would argue that Montana Hanna versus Hall, but does touch on the statute and the purpose that improperly worded indictments can be re-indicted on a properly worded charging instrument.
Does it make a difference if the variance is the offense charged rather than what would otherwise be surplusage, the name of the victim?
No, Your Honor. This court and multiple courts that I've cited in brief have found that it's not surplusage, whether it's the name of the victim, the residence.
All of the cases that you have cited, I think, involve an instance where the person was indicted for the wrong offense, that basically that the evidence didn't support the offense charged, and the court said you can charge it again under the proper offense. But I'm not aware of any case that deals with the name of the victim.
Off the top of my head, I don't know of one where it has gotten to that point. I mean, obviously, Gardner and Etheridge deal with names of victims and fatal variances, but they don't really talk about, they aren't at the second instance where this case is. But Burris v. Commonwealth, which is a much older case, was an indictment that found that the difference in the amount alleged in the indictment was a material variance. And I think that might be what the court's trying to kind of question me on, is whether or not it just matters exactly if some, like, burglary versus, like a larceny versus a false pretenses indictment, or like actual surplus wordage can be different. And I think Burris is a case that is more like that, where it was the same correct offense statute, but it was different language that made it a variance, and the court found it was not barred by a previous acquittal.
Would you agree that if this case was reindicted with the name of the other of the child as opposed to the mother, that would be a prosecution for this? The offense would be the same.
No, Your Honor, I would not agree with that. It is a different crime, and that's precisely why the fatal variance was found in the granting the motion to strike, because it.
But the name was not necessary to include in the indictment. The indictment could have just said the property of another.
Correct, Your Honor. But by the Commonwealth choosing to be precise, it limited itself to what the crime actually was. And when the trial court found that the evidence varied from the crime that was alleged, it was necessarily saying that the Commonwealth charged an offense that was different from the one the Commonwealth was attempting to prove. Therefore, the second indictment was a different crime than the one that was first indicted.
You're into your rebuttal. You may reserve or continue as you wish.
I'll reserve. Thank you, Your Honor.
Lindsay?
Yes, Your Honors. May it please the Court, Brad Lindsay with the Fairfax County Office of the Public Defender on behalf of Mr. Flight. We are asking this court to affirm the trial court's ruling, as it was not plainly wrong or without evidence to support it. As the court is aware, this court must view the findings of fact at trial and all reasonable inferences fairly deduced therefrom in the light most favorable to the prevailing party, Mr. Flight.
Mr. Lindsay, this is a review of a double jeopardy issue. We review double jeopardy issues de novo, don't we?
That is correct, Your Honor. However, all findings of fact at the trial level are still reviewed under the plainly wrong or without evidence to support it.
Don't we review the basis for the original acquittal de novo?
Your Honor, I believe that all the entire findings of fact made by the court, the trial court, are reviewed on the plainly wrong standard.
But is a determination of whether a person has been acquitted based on insufficient evidence a factual finding, or isn't that rather a legal finding in a double jeopardy context?
Well, Your Honor, I think it's a factual finding, because I think the trial court has to weigh all of the evidence, and it's a sufficiency argument. So therefore, it is a factual finding by the trial court about whether or not there's sufficient evidence to proceed with this charge. I would point out to the court that a trial court has the authority to interpret its own orders. That has been recognized by this court. And when construing a lower court's order, a reviewing court should give great deference to the interpretation adopted by that lower court. And in this case, the Commonwealth bears the burden of showing that the trial court's ruling in granting the motion to dismiss was plainly wrong and without evidence to support it. And I would just first go to the trial court. The motion to dismiss had the entirety of the case. It had the transcript from the jury trial. It had my motion to dismiss filed on March 13th and again on March 17th. It had the Commonwealth's response on March 23rd. It had my reply brief on March 26th before the hearing. And it is clear from the questioning at the motion to dismiss that the trial court understood all the issues in great detail and had reviewed the matter thoroughly. And as the trial court aptly stated in its ruling and at the motion to dismiss several times, that this was a fatal theory by the Commonwealth, not a fatal variance or error in the indictment. The trial court made factual findings on the record that Mr. Flythe was acquitted on the merits. And that's also supported by what happened at the jury trial.
Let me refer you to a recent case we decided on Bonk, Davis versus Commonwealth. That was a collateral estoppel case, but collateral estoppel is a species of double jeopardy. And in that case, we said that the appellate court, determine the basis for the original acquittal, not the trial court. And it seems to me, and we cite some fairly strong U.S. Supreme Court cases for that proposition. It seems to me that principle of law is applicable here, that we don't really care too much what the trial court found as the basis for the acquittal, because we're just as capable of reviewing those transcripts and coming to conclusion as the trial court.
Well, Your Honor, I think that would then subvert kind of the appellate process in terms of arguing sufficiency. If this were reversed and I was arguing that the conviction of Mr. Flythe was insufficient as a matter of law, the court takes great deference into the trial court's findings of fact made. And the appellate court is not to disturb that opinion unless it is plainly wrong. I believe that this court, the Court of Appeals, applies great deference to the fact finder because, as the court often cites in its opinions, they are the ones who heard the evidence, had the opportunity to observe the witnesses, and preside over the trial. The Court of Appeals, by its very nature of being an appellate court, is somewhat robbed of that component. So that's why the Court of Appeals, applies great deference to the trial court's findings of fact made at trial and will not disturb them unless plainly wrong.
If we conclude that this motion to strike was granted based on a fatal variance, that the offense charged or the offense proven was not the offense charged, does that require reversal?
Your Honor, I do not believe it requires reversal because, as it is plainly in the record, this was the Commonwealth's chosen theory. The court, at the motion to dismiss, went at length to talk about that this was the theory of the case. The warrant of arrest, as I pointed out in my brief, was issued on July 25th, 2013, and listed her as the owner of the property. And the Commonwealth stated at trial, it's charged in the indictment that it's the mother's money. And then arguing in the first motion to strike, the Commonwealth states, so first my position is that Sandra Murillo is the owner of the money. And then later on says, as I said, it is my position, the Commonwealth's position, is that Sandra Murillo is the owner of that property, which is why the Commonwealth elected to proceed with Sandra Murillo as the victim of the crime. That's a quote from App at 263, and the previous ones were from Appendix at 261. The Commonwealth...
But I understand that, but if we decide that this motion was granted based upon a legal defect in the charging indictment, why wouldn't the cases cited by the Commonwealth, that Montana v. Hall case, our Purvey case, why wouldn't they require reversal?
Your Honor, I think in those cases we are talking about a error or a clerical error made in the indictment. If the court reverses this decision, it is on a much different grain because this is the Commonwealth's chosen theory. They chose, even admitting to the trial court, they believe they could amend the indictment if they wanted to, but they chose to proceed under this theory. And as the court is well aware, a prosecutor has broad discretion in charging whether or not to prosecute and what charges to file. They have the ability to charge the defendant under multiple theories for the same crime, but to allow the Commonwealth to essentially have an entire dry run at prosecution and then argue for the first time on appeal that it somehow made a procedural or clerical error when at no time at the trial court did it state that, at no time at the motion to dismiss did the Commonwealth admit or concede that it made a clerical error, then this gives the Commonwealth almost unbridled ability to charge indictments this way, and if they don't succeed on them, then they have at least honed in on their trial strategy and perfected the evidence in successive attempts. This would allow them to presumably continue to charge Mr. Flythe with him of no guarantee that he would ever be able to rest peace in mind that when he is acquitted by a trial court, that that is a finality of the ruling. And I would point the court out to, in Hargraves v. Commonwealth, which is cited in my brief, the trial court has many options at motion to strike. The court may allow the Commonwealth to reopen its case after a motion to strike has been made. The court can grant a defendant's motion to strike as to one element, or the court can fully acquit the defendant. In Hargraves, which is 219 Virginia 604, the trial court, after expressing doubts regarding the Commonwealth's case at motion to strike, but after the Commonwealth had, of course, already rested, allowed the Commonwealth to reopen its case over defense counsel's objection to provide additional evidence. There, the defendant was charged with robbery. The defense counsel made a motion to strike based on identification and whether or not there was sufficient evidence to place the defendant at the scene. The judge expressed doubts that the Commonwealth had made its case, but permitted the Commonwealth to reopen its case and call an additional witness to testify that the only place the cab driver who was robbed went was the defendant girlfriend's address. I would also point the court to Sandoval v. Commonwealth, which came out of the Court of Appeals, and that's 2006 Virginia App Lexus 51, and there the defendant was charged with animate object sexual penetration. At the time of the close of the Commonwealth's evidence, the defendant made a motion to strike based on no evidence of force. So the motion and the judge's order stated that Sandoval moved to strike the evidence of the Commonwealth on the grounds that the Commonwealth had failed to prove the element of force, threat, or intimidation. The order further states that the trial court sustained the motion with regard to that charge. The Court of Appeals stated the order, however, did not expressly state or otherwise indicate whether Sandoval was fully acquitted of the charges or whether the indictments were dismissed. The Court of Appeals held that the trial court was clear that in granting the motion to strike, it did so for a particular element, but did not state that it had fully acquitted the defendant, and that was the understanding of all the parties. We have the exact opposite in this case. The motion to strike was granted. The order does not limit the granting of the motion to strike to any particular element. And as Your Honor pointed out previously, Rule 3A15C states that the only way for a motion to strike to be granted and dismissed is that on an insufficient as a matter of law to sustain a conviction. Any other reason for setting aside or the case, it would set a new trial date. But the order here expressly dismissed the case. The order in this case expressly released the defendant and discharged the case against him, therefore dismissing the indictment. The only similarity between the cases is that in both Sandoval and this case, after the granting of the motion to strike, the Commonwealth moved to amend the charge. In Sandoval, the court allowed the amendment because it found it had not fully acquitted the defendant. In this case, it is much trial court's acquittal went to the merits of the case as found by the trial court at the motion to dismiss. The Commonwealth argued briefly today in its reply brief that these statements by the trial court are somehow taken out of context, but it's precisely the opposite. The case that it relies on for taking judges' off-the-cuff remarks from the bench was Mason v. Commonwealth, which came from this court as well at 64 Virginia App 292, and that was a judge who was essentially stating on the record during a motion to suppress that it was inclined to grant, but that it wanted more time to think about it, and that court took a view of the scene of where the where the stop allegedly occurred, and the trial court came back and ultimately denied the motion to suppress, stating that it acknowledged it was operating under a wrong legal standard, and that's when the defense counsel argued that the trial court had already made factual findings. But this case, the remarks made by the trial court are not off the cuff, but a part of her holding. It provides this court and provided a later trial court at the motion to dismiss context into granting the motion to strike. Had it not been a full acquittal, the court easily could have allowed the amendment to the indictment for the Commonwealth, but the court did not limit her ruling. She compared it to a jury verdict and stated on the record she was finding the defendant not guilty. By the Commonwealth's own concession, if it is a decision on the merits, then they are barred from proceeding again. And that's exactly what a jury verdict of an acquittal and a defendant being found not guilty would do. And this, Your Honors, comes as no surprise because the Commonwealth, as I stated earlier, always argued this issue in terms of sufficiency, that the Commonwealth had sufficiently proven that Sandra Murillo was the owner. That was from the warrant of arrest and all of the quotations that I stated, mainly at Appendix 260 to 61. The Commonwealth states, as I said, it is my position, the Commonwealth's position, is that Sandra Murillo is the owner of that property.
Mr. Lindsay, you have used all your allotted time. I wonder if you'd bring it to conclusion, please.
Yes, Your Honors, and I do apologize, and I appreciate that.
Oh, no problem.
The trial court was not plainly wrong or without evidence to support its finding at the motion to dismiss, the acquittal at trial on the merits. The trial court at the motion to dismiss had everything it needed to make its decision. The trial court determined that it was on the merits. Therefore, we are requesting this court to affirm the trial court's decision in granting Mr. Fleiss' motion to dismiss as the second indictment violated his double jeopardy rights under the U.S. and Virginia Constitution. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Lindsay. Ms. Campbell, you have your rebuttal remaining.
Thank you, Your Honor. The Commonwealth would just like to first turn to the holding of the first trial court in granting the motion and striking the indictments. On page 355, the trial court plainly says, I find that there is a fatal variance existing between the indictment's allegation and the evidence that was presented, and I'm going to strike, and I'm granting the motion to just strike. At that point, the Commonwealth does attempt to amend the indictments, and the defendant objects because the trial court has already ruled on the motion. And this
Campbell,
trial court,
can I ask you, and this came up as I was listening to Mr. Lindsay, I want to ask you about that motion to amend the indictment. And I'm asking it in relation to your comment earlier that a re-indictment naming another victim would constitute a separate offense. You can only amend an indictment if it doesn't change the nature of the offense. If, as you argue, that changing the name of the victim creates a whole new offense, how could the Commonwealth move to amend?
I don't know that the Commonwealth could move to amend.
Well, they did.
They did, and it was denied.
And they argued that an amendment was proper.
They argue it, but it clearly was not proper at that point in time.
Well, would it have been proper earlier?
I think the Commonwealth could always have attempted to move to amend it, but I think as you point out, I think the defendant could have raised an objection that he was not properly put on notice for that crime based on it being a different allegation and proof.
And so are you arguing something different from what the Commonwealth argued below?
At the first trial, the Commonwealth, do you mean at the first trial, or are you talking about at the motion to dismiss?
I'm arguing now on appeal. Are you arguing something different from what the prosecutor argued second trial to Judge Nordland.
At the second trial, at the motion to dismiss, the Commonwealth attorney was arguing that there had been a fatal variance. The record was very plainly clear that there had been a fatal variance. She had re-indicted based on that ruling, and that it did not violate double jeopardy based on 19.2293. And when the trial court at the second hearing told her that she found that it was a fatal theory, they disagreed, going back and forth on 378 and 380. But, Your Honor, I don't believe I'm arguing anything different from what she's arguing.
Okay. Thank you.
Yes, Your Honor. The Commonwealth would just, again, reiterate that the second trial court was wrong based on her comments and that she did not give deference to the first original final ruling that was a fatal variance in the first trial. It was not a fatal theory. The defendant is the one who moved for the finding of the fatal variance. The Commonwealth did not ask for the finding of the fatal variance. The trial court accepted the defendant's legal position that there was a fatal variance and dismissed the first case. Therefore, the Commonwealth, under this court and the statute, could reindict for the under a properly charged indictment, and that is what the Commonwealth is attempting to do. And therefore, the trial court was wrong in dismissing it based on double jeopardy grounds. And if there are no further questions, the Commonwealth would just ask that you reverse the trial court's decision dismissing the case.
Thank you very much, Ms. Campbell. Mr. Lindsay, the case is submitted. We will adjourn and reconvene in conference.
Thank you very much, Your Honor.
Thank you.